Nếu như
globalization, to a large extent, is actually removing responsibility from people within their own locality to take care of themselves.
We know that people do not know who rules or why and how he rules. And yet they know that there is a power that certainly rules.
We travel 1,000 miles in an hour and a half. We have traveled through whole areas of existence which we have not necessarily gained. We will pop into a Hindu village, but we won't know a damn thing about that Hindu village.
If you push that all the way, you see, what it means is that we will increasingly tend to inhabit all of these areas in depth simultaneously.
Južna hemisfera. Vsako drugo sredo poročamo o južni polobli. Točno o poldan.
V današnji južni hemisferi se bomo zadržali v Maleziji, na otoku Borneo, v pokrajini Sabah. Razlog za to je oborožen konflikt med Malezijo in sledniki suluškega sultana Jamalula Kirama III., ki so 10. februarja z namenom pridobiti nazaj lastninske pravice pripluli v Sabah. Od takrat je okoli 400 oboroženih islamistov ustrajalo na otoku, ko pa je malezijska vlada zagrozila z orožjem, ki ga je kasneje tudi uporabila, je v Sabah prispela okrepljena gverilska vojska z otoka Simunul iz Filipinov. Situacija je sedaj skrajno zapletena in brez pravih rešitev na obzorju. Zgodba ima sicer dolgo zgodovinsko podlago. Začetki segajo v leto 1878, ko je takratni suluški sultan Sri Paduka Maulana al-Sultan Mohamed Jamalul Alam dal severni del Borneja v najem britansko-vzhodno-indijski družbi. Ključna težava te pogodbe je bila v tem, da ni bilo povsem jasno, ali je šlo za najem za določen ali nedoločen čas. Z nekaterimi umestnimi etapami je kasneje družba pogodbo predala britanski kolonialni vladi. In kasneje, ko se je leta 1963 Malezija osamosvojila, je ta ostala gospodarica nad ozemljem severnega Borneja. Malezija suluškemu sultanu še danes plačuje tudi najemnino, ki znaša približno 1500 ameriških dolarjev. Konfliktu in stanju v Maleziji in pa tudi na Filipinih smo se pogovarjali z dvema novinarkama. Zrani Tilaganathan iz Malezije, ki pokriva severni Borneo, in z Marites Dangoilan Vitug iz Filipinov. Začenjamo s Tilaganathanovo, ki nam predstavi zadnje dogajanje v Sabahu, ki je prvo takšno v malezijski zgodovini in nadaljuje z vzroki, zakaj je do konflikta prišlo ravno sedaj in kako se je sam konflikt sploh razvijal.
The current situation in Sabah, as of now, there's ongoing gunfights in the area, in the security zone. The Malaysian authorities have more or less cordoned off areas. Pahat Datu, Sandakan, Kudat, these are all the east coast belt. As of now, Malaysian government has, the Malaysian securities have detained some 85 people for investigations. We've had 60 people dead, attackers dead. And Malaysian security has lost 9 personnel.
Were there any conflicts between Malaysia forces and Sultan of Sulu followers in the past?
There have been no armed conflicts with the Sulus as such in the recognizable past.
So this is the first conflict, and before were conflict only by, I don't know, legal ways and some other ways, but not never.
Yes. This is the first time. There has been no armed conflicts with the Sulus as such in the recognizable past. Whatever negotiations has come via the Philippines authorities through diplomatic channels.
Mm-hmm. And why do you believe that this fightings started just now? Is there any special reason for that, or you cannot say nothing about that?
To be honest with you, I think the intrusion by the Sulus took all Malaysians by surprise, Sabahans by surprise. Over the weeks following the intrusion, we've realized that the Sulu-Sabah issue is very complicated. Sulu and Sabah have a history that dates back to the early 1900s. Hence, it has been difficult to pin the exact reason for the conflict. But aside from this, the Sulu Sultanate's demands for respect and recognition, they're also demanding for a review of the annual fee paid to them by Malaysia. And then we have the fact that the Kirams, the Sulu Sultanate, the Kirams themselves are very angry that they were left out of the peace negotiation brokered by Malaysia in 2012. That negotiation was led by the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, MILF. MILF is actually a splinter from the Moro National Liberation Front soldiers, which Malaysia themselves trained in the past. On February, the first time we heard reports of the invasion was in February, was on February 12th. We read the Royal Sulu Army had taken over the Tandao village in Lahad Datu in Sabah. But even as the Malaysia security forces set up the security cordon, more Sulu Army soldiers started slipping through the Sabah. Sabah has a very porous border. The Malaysian side said they were in secret negotiations with the invaders, but the Sulu Sultanate insisted on meeting the Malaysian leaders. Malaysia demanded that the invaders surrender unconditionally and withdraw before any discussions began, but they refused to surrender. So in total, there was a three-week standoff, which ended in a shootout on February 22nd here, and the Malaysian side claims that the Sulu militants broke through the security cordon. The militants, of course, deny this. The standoff it decelerated into an unrest gunfight with reports of alleged mutilation of the dead. So to date, we have 60 of the invaders killed, and Malaysia has lost 9 security personnel. Now what we have is a guerrilla-style warfare. So even as I speak, there's gunfights going on.
And militants. They are hiding where? Are there some forests or what kind of...
Sabah itself is one of the most well-known rainforests in the world. I think that, if I'm not mistaken, it's the second or third largest in the world. Most of the militants are hiding because Sabah was where they had trained. Apparently, they had trained many, many years ago. So the basic gunfights are happening in pockets of villages and throughout the stretch.
Could you tell us a little more about that? Why Malaysia government trained those militants? Why? What was the reason for that?
Actually, I don't specialize in terrorism per se, but from what my understanding is that it's basically self-protection. There has been a lot of speculations in the past, reports in the past that Malaysia had helped train the Moros National Liberation Front fighters from southern Mindanao. Southern Mindanao is very close to Malaysian borders. A lot of the Sulus from southern Mindanao have actually migrated and moved into Malaysia. They are Malaysian citizens because during decades of war, civil unrest in southern Mindanao, a lot of them had run away to Malaysia and seeked asylum here. So there's a huge population of Sulus who are now Malaysians living in Sabah. That's from the Philippine side. From the Malaysian, from the Indonesian side, there's been reports that Malaysia has got a link with the Achenese fighters as well. So it's I think it's self protection. Malaysia is a small strip. You know, we're strapped. We are straddled by Philippines, Thailand, and Indonesia on the side.
Sledniki sultana Jamalula Kirama III. Torej z gverilskim bojem ostajajo v Sabahu. Na drugi strani pa Malezija ne popušča, kar pomeni, da se stvar razvija v dolgotrajno vojno, ki je sedaj v fazi gverilskega bojevanja. Tila Ganatanova v nadaljevanju nekoliko osvetli zgodovinski in politični okvir, ki je privedel do današnje situacije in pove nekaj o zahtevah sultanovih privržencev in sultana samega. Govori pa tudi o odzivih prebivalcev, ki so se znašli med dvema ognjema in o odzivu malezijske vlade.
The issues are quite complicated, but I think what we understand from reports from both sides is that the core issue, I believe, started off with the rent. Malaysia pays a levy, a fee to the Sulu Sultanate, the Kirams, and that apparently has not been reviewed for a long time, and they have been trying very hard to go through the Filipino diplomatic channel to get the Malaysian authorities to look at it and the Philippines to relook at the terms of the contract, which was signed a long time ago, not between Malaysia and the Sulus, but rather contracts that were signed with the British during that time. That is the main core issue that the Kirams have. They want a review. They also want the Philippines government to recognize them as a sultanate. That's an internal issue with the Philippines that they're having, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what about people who lives in those areas? How do they respond? Do they move out or they stay at their homes?
There have been reports of people living in the crisis area, fleeing the crisis area. I think there's a lot of fear. Schools were closed from Friday February 22nd. They just opened. They opened yesterday and Friday. Almost a week, schools were closed. Businesses were closed. It was almost as if there were a curfew, but there is no official announcement of a curfew.
What about Malaysia government? I read that the response was quite violent and that it was maybe too violent. What do you think about that?
I think Malaysia was fair because for the first 3 weeks they went into negotiations. They were gentle. They were gentle with how they handled the Sulu Royal Army. They only declared them terrorists on Friday, February 22nd onwards. Mind you, this group had arrived quietly on February 9th. It was and on February 12th the first media reports came out. And the government had been very, very gentle with the negotiations with them. Why, we really don't know. There's so many other related political and non-political issues as far as this particular matter is concerned. When the crisis broke, when the shootout broke out from February 2nd, from then on we've literally had a war on our hands. The Malaysian government has refused to scale back. They're very angry with the way things have turned out.
What about the Philippines government? What do they do about this? Nevertheless, these fighters, they are Philippines citizens.
There have been calls, and this is based on reports coming out of Philippines. There have been calls for the Philippines to intervene and to insist on Malaysia taking care of those who were arrested. We've had that as well. Philippines, on their part, is under international pressure to ensure the human rights issues in Malaysia is taken care of. Malaysia does not have a good track record of human rights practices.
Mm-hmm. I also speak with one of the Filipinos journalist and she said to me that it is the all news which came from Malaysia came from Malaysia reports. So there is no journalists from Filipinos allowed in Sabah. Why is that so, and is that really so?
As far as Malaysia is concerned, there is a blackout on news, on information. We as Malaysian journalists have had a major problem getting news information coming out. There is a 20 I think there's a 20 km border. Reporters are not allowed to go beyond that. Media is not allowed into the areas where the crisis is actually happening. There is an unofficial security perimeter. So as far as Malaysia is concerned, there is a news blackout. They have, the Malaysian authorities are not keen on having too much being told about what's happening. We are fairly dependent on what is coming out on, from the Philippines and whatever is available on the blogs and from our sources on the ground. The official channels are not carrying, are only carrying the official story.
And why is that so? Is there something that they have to hide?
Malaysia, as a rule, has always been very, very conservative with their media democracy. Malaysia has always been conservative. Freedom of press is very subjective here.
Kot smo slišali, je problem tudi v samem dostopu do informacij, s katerimi skopari malezijska vlada. Nadaljujemo s pogledom na konflikt v Severnem Borneju iz filipinske perspektive. Na začetku smo tudi filipinsko novinarko Marites Danguilan Vitug vprašali, kako je do oboroženega spora prišlo ravno v tem trenutku.
The conflict happened now under President Aquino because the heirs of the Sultan of Sulu felt left out of the peace process of the government with the Muslim rebels. They felt they were not, consulted, or they felt that they were not given attention by this government. Because in the past presidents talked to them, sent emissaries to them, met with them and discussed what they can do to help them resolve their private claims to Sabah. But this time, President Aquino, I think, ignored them or did not recognize that their claim was legitimate.
Could you talk about if people support it and who support it, who don't?
The country is divided on this issue. Some support the armed followers of the Sultan of Sulu. They call it the intrusion into Sabah. Some denounce it, others denounce it. Some are pushing that the government revive its claim to Sabah. Others are saying, no, we should not. Let's just keep this in the back burner because Malaysia is brokering peace talks with the Muslim rebels. So it's divided. But the Philippine government's position is to study the claim further and just resolve this crisis first before going into talks on whether to pursue the claim or not. So we're divided on this. Many Filipinos are upset because the armed followers have disturbed the livelihood of about 800,000 overseas Filipinos working in Malaysia. And some of these are illegals, they are not documented, and many have been deported back to the Philippines. So relations between Philippines and Malaysia are really unstable at this point. And we used to enjoy very, very warm relations. So this is the first time since 1990s that we have very bad relations with Malaysia.
And what do you think will that have any effect on the future relations between two states?
Yes, definitely. First, it has to be, the Philippines has to be very clear on where it stands on the Sabah claim. Because if the Philippine government pursues the Sabah claim, then definitely this will divide Malaysia and the Philippines, and also ASEAN, Association of Southeast Asian Nations, to which we belong. However, if the Philippines goes back to its old position of putting the claim in the back burner, meaning it's just there, we don't renounce it, but it's just there, it's dormant, then this will improve our relations with Malaysia. But the Philippine government also has to attend to the private claim of the heirs. The heirs should unite, have one person negotiate their claims with Malaysia.
Kot pravi Vitugova, je problem tudi v tem, da sedanji filipinski predsednik Benigno Aquino nima nikakršnega posluha do muslimanskih vprašanj in zahtev, kar islamsko manjšino na Filipinih še posebej jezi. Na drugi strani pa je filipinska javnost glede invazije njihovih državljanov na Sabah razcepljena, pri čemer se postavlja tudi vprašanje prihodnjega, trenutno sicer dobrega odnosa med državama. Vitugova nadaljuje s problemom pomankanja informacij iz Sabaha, pri čemer kritizira tudi neodzivnost malezijske vlade na poziv po enostranskem prenehanju ognja in vključitvi meddržavnega sodišča v spor.
There's a problem here because Malaysia has a controlled press and we do not get enough information. We get information from the Malaysian government, from the Malaysian press sometimes, and from the side of the heirs. Our government also gets information from the Malaysian government, so we really lack real information on the ground. But it is true that it took 3 weeks. The journalist from Sabah is factual, because it really took 3 weeks before the Malaysian authorities started to run after the followers of the Sultan of Sulu. However, the leader of the group already called for a unilateral ceasefire a few days ago, but Malaysia rejected it. So this is a difficult position now, and even the UN has made a statement, Ban Ki-moon, saying that this should be resolved peacefully, but Malaysia has declined or rejected the ceasefire offer.
And why do you think that is so? Why they don't want to talk? Because as I heard at the beginning, they tried to do it through diplomatic ways, and like there was no right answer from invaders, from followers of Sultan and Sultan himself.
Yeah, I'll try to speculate, but my sense is that Malaysia doesn't want to entertain. Doesn't want to accept the unilateral ceasefire call of the followers of the Sultan, because they think they're now in the upper hand, you know, that they can now resolve this, and rather than let it go on for a longer time. Because, you know, since Filipinos look like Malaysians, these armed followers of the Sultan can easily mix with the locals, with the villagers in Sabah. So it will be an insurgency. There will be an insurgency. So I think Malaysia really wants to put an end to it now rather than delay it.
Mm-hmm. As I know, in 1963, if I'm right, the referendum was taken in Borneo, in Sabah. The day.
Correct. Yes.
I'm correct.
Yes.
That they want to stay in Malaysia state. So
that's right.
In some way, we can say that they decided and they have this legal right now to be there. What do you think about it?
Yes, that's true. In the principle of self-determination, the Sabah residents voted to join the Federation of Malaysia. So that's the status now. And that's why some legal experts in the Philippines are saying that if we pursue our claim now with the International Court of Justice, we have a weak position, because in 1963, as you said, the people of Sabah already decided to stay with Malaysia. But some of our politicians are saying that this referendum, you know, they were pressured to vote for Malaysia, but, you know, we don't know. But the fact is, they have voted to be with Malaysia. So it's tricky at this point. Beneficial at this point now to go to the ICJ and make a claim. I think let's see how things unfold first, because as you said, in 1963 the principle of self-determination was observed in the referendum.
But are there any talkings that maybe this referendum should be made again?
That's what some of our politicians are saying now, that if we go to ICJ, then maybe there can be another referendum. That's the talk. That's one of the ideas here. But the Philippine government, the Philippine president, says that all this talk should come later. He just wants first to resolve the crisis in Sabah before these kinds of talk. He will entertain these kinds of ideas.
So what are the relations between Christians and the Muslims in Philippines?
I travel to Mindanao occasionally, and I see the Christians and the Muslims getting along well. In fact, we have interfaith dialogues. Of course, there is some prejudice. It can't be avoided. Some Christians, you know, don't like Muslims, but there is no violent manifestation. We don't have persecution. So it's generally very cordial.
V zadnjem delu oddaje se bomo na kratko sprehodili še skozi druge teme iz Malezije. Rani Tilaganathan smo tako vprašali, v kakšni meri so ljudska gibanja in civilna javnost prisotna v državi.
If you're talking in terms of Malaysia as a whole, as a country, then the last 4 years, last 5 years has actually seen a whole new awakening. In fact, I think from 2000, the first real significant wake-up call, I think, was in November 2007. Before that was in 1999, when the Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim was arrested and detained. And at that point, they kicked off a whole revolution called the Reformasi, which is a Reformation revolution, and that sort of triggered a call for change in Malaysia itself. And in 2007, there was a massive rally here by the Malaysian minorities called Indians, and that put a lot of pressure on the ruling government, which filtered into the general elections, which was called in 2008 March. And that general elections was very defining, because it was for the first time in the Malaysian history the ruling party lost 5 states. It recovered one state in a reverse takeover the following year. And so in terms of what is brewing in Malaysia, there is a lot of unhappiness. The opposition is getting stronger by the day. We have a lot of young voters in Malaysia now who are pushing for change of leadership, pushing for a change in policies, pushing for more democratization of basic rights in the country involving race and religion, and so forth.
And what was those reforms which make people so angry that they went to the streets?
The issues that were of concern to Malaysia was one of the main issues was the Internal Security Act, which has since been repealed, but now we have a new act in place. That was one of the main issues, one of the major issues that were fought on during the elections. There was also other economic and social reform and social development issues that were affecting the Malaysians. Things like education, things like jobs in civil service. There was a lot of racist-driven policies and execution in the country, which basically shortchanged Malaysians, the non-Muslim Malaysians. There was also a lot of disregard for the constitution, which federal constitution, which provides for the rights of all communities in the country. There is the Bumiputras in Malaysia have are in a privileged situation.
Za konec nas je zanimalo, kako je s plantažami oljne palme, ki so v preteklem desetletju preplavile Malezijo, s čimer je bilo uničenega mnogo deževnega gozda in izseljenih na tisoče staroselcev.
Yes, in the last decade we've had a increased we have definitely increased our hectareage of palm oil plantations, particularly in Sabah and Sarawak, in Borneo. Sarawak, I think, has got a Sarawak and Sabah has a vast expanse. I think more than, if I'm not mistaken, more than 60% of oil palm comes from Sabah and Sarawak. This crisis in Sabah has actually caused a problem because there, some of the plants have had to shut down because they depend on foreign workers, and a lot of the workers in Sabah, palm oil plants come from Indonesia and the Philippines. A lot of them actually from Indonesia. Palm oil is one of our main exports now. So if most conservationists in Malaysia, environmentalists in Malaysia are against the wiping, you know, the cutting down of our rainforest and the planting of oil palm. That's true. But whether it is extensive, how extensive it is in relation to the land acreage, it's actually subjective, because some places have more than the rest. Some places have more, some places have less. Sarawak has been in the international media for some time now, because apparently there's a very large percentage of their land that's been wiped out.
What about indigenous people? They are displaced.
Yes. The issue is, It's a very real issue in Sarawak. It's a very, very real issue in Sarawak, because indigenous rights are far more anchored in Sarawak than in Sabah. The government in Sabah, in Sarawak, is basically a single man. His name is Taib Mahmud, and it's been written all over the place. Actually, it's a well known issue in the media. About the deforestation in Sabah, in Sarawak, sorry, Sarawak.
And I presume that the common people don't have so much from it.
I think, you know, like all regimes, and it is a regime in Sarawak, it is a regime in Malaysia, the wealth doesn't trickle down as much as it should to the ordinary people. So the people who are displaced, although the government has got, although the state government of Sarawak has got plans and policies in place for displaced people, it doesn't meet the needs of the indigenous community.
Južno hemisfero je pripravil Gregor.
Globalization, to a large extent, is actually removing responsibility from people within their own locality to take care of themselves.
We know that people do not know who rules or why and how he rules. And yet they know that there is a power that certainly rules.
And we travel 1,000 miles in an hour and a half. We have traveled through whole areas of existence which we have not necessarily gained. We will pop into a Hindu village, but we won't know a damn thing about that Hindu village.
If you push that all the way, you see, what it means is that we will increasingly tend to inhabit all of these areas in depth simultaneously.
Južna hemisfera. Vsako drugo sredo poročamo o južni polobli. Točno opoldan.